You're listening to Knobs, a podcast created by music geeks for music geeks. Brought to you in part by 44 North. Now, here's your hosts, Matt Diamond and Chris Nickel.
Welcome back to episode 16 already. My name is Matt Diamond. I am your host of this episode of Knobs. Chris Nickel is, busy living his life, but I thought I'd attack this one solo today. And this fine program, of course, brought to you by ART Pro Audio at artproaudio.com. Real special episode today. We're going to touch on who the guest is and give you a little backstory and some info, etc. But before we do that, I want to say thanks for the outpouring of support for the last two-part interview with Nels Klein that we did for episodes 14 and 15. Wilco fans going crazy for this stuff, and I know for a fact that I had so many different emails and just, you know, supporters who are big fans of that guy. And how could you not love him? I mean, even if you didn't know who Nels Klein is, listening to him talk and how candid and personal and down to earth he was, it was just a really, really special moment for the show. And I mean, like, let's face it, who better than a guy like Nels Klein to be on a show like this, right? Today's guest certainly fits into that exact same category. In fact, Eric Bachmann has been the subject of many an interview, or at least a little audio piece that I've done on Eric in the past, whether it be for his solo records or through Crooked Fingers. I also did a video interview with him and Matt Gentling of Archers of Loaf back, well, I guess it's going back 4 or 5 years ago now, when they came to town for North by Northeast as well. And if you want to YouTube that, you can go check that out. It's on YouTube as well. But the simple fact is that he and I have some history together, and my wife and I have traveled to the States a few different times to go see Crooked Fingers play. Now, here's the thing. If you don't know who Eric Bachmann is, his career started out as being the front man of a really awesome alt-rock band or indie rock band called Archers of Loaf back in the 90s that carried right through until the early 2000s, and then they pulled the plug on that thing. And throughout this interview, we discuss what it was like to go from being in an angsty kind of rock band that's super loud to doing some more stripped back kind of folky elements like he does with Crooked Fingers. And Eric Bachmann just released an absolutely beautiful solo record. It is a self-titled album. It is simply called Eric Bachmann. It features him as a kid holding a baseball bat on the cover, like him in his uniform. And it's got some beautiful songs on it, some heavy stuff. It's really piano driven. And I guess the focus of this particular interview is coming right off of the heels of a road trip that two friends of mine took with me. Actually, we drove from Peterborough, Ontario, all the way to Cincinnati, because Eric Bachmann is doing a living room tour that is not coming to Ontario. So I thought, you know what, guys, let's pack up the car, let's hit the road for a little bit here. And I introduced them to his music a little bit beforehand, but I guess the kicker was to not only meet Eric Bachmann, but to see him play with 50 people in a living room in Cincinnati. And it was a really, really special night. And, thanks again to the hosts of that party. And we got tickets for that. And it was just a great road trip. And the music was wonderful. And like I had said, I have seen Eric Bachmann several different times before, but this was certainly the most, intimate affair that I've been a part of. So I think maybe we should just get right into it. He is a very, very friendly gentleman. He's also huge. And if you haven't seen any of these photos, I'll go put them up on the description too. I'm 6'2". This guy towers over me, all right? He is a gentle giant. He has a beautiful kind of a gravelly tone to his voice. It's just such an honest, earnest songwriter. And I am so excited to have Eric Bachmann as today's guest on the show. So I'm going to leave you with this. If you don't know any of his music, go and get it. There is absolutely no relation to Randy Bachmann, us being Canadian, of course. No relation to the Guess Who guitar player, Randy Bachmann. He is his own entity, this guy. And I promise that if you're not familiar with Eric Bachmann's music or Crooked Fingers or Archers or any of that stuff, you will be a fan. All right. Start out by going to get what we call the Swan Record, which is the very first self-titled Crooked Fingers album. I'm going to ask you to get an album called Red Devil Dawn. I'm going to ask you to get an album called Dignity and Shame. And then from there, I'm going to ask you to get, all of it, really. But I'm going to ask you to get a solo record from Eric Bachmann called To the Races. And we touch on all of these albums. And then, of course, the more recent Merge release, All of the Crooked Finger stuff, with the exception of To The Races, have been merged releases, if I'm not mistaken. And if I am, I apologize. But I urge you, go out, get this brand new one. All right. The brand new Eric Bachmann. It's self-titled. It's beautiful. You're going to love it. I'm going to shut up. Let's get into it. Today's episode, Eric Bachmann, right here on Knobs. What time does a guy like Eric Bachmann wake up at?
I got up around 6:30 this morning.
So what are you doing at 6:30?
I don't always get up at 6:30, but more recently I feel like I want to get up early. My wife gets up early to go to work at 7. She's got a shift starting at 7, and she's gone 12 hours. If I get up that time, then I can get a lot done musically in the house because I can make as much noise as I want.
So is that a bit of a ritual for you then?
It's starting to be. The last month or so.
And, of course, as we just spoke, Liz is a nurse now.
She is, among many other things, but yeah.
Well, I can't tell you how much of an honor it is to have you here on the show. Of course, Eric, you and I just saw each other, it seems like a week ago, because it's under a week ago, as you are doing the living room tour thing, and a carload of friends of mine and I drove to Cincinnati from Toronto to see you. Is that current living room tour all done right now?
It's done, just the first leg of it. I start again next Tuesday in Greensboro, so it's kind of in the middle. I did a week, then I was home for a week, and now I have another week.
So tell me about it. How does it feel? How did it start? Let's talk about the living room thing before we dive into this other stuff.
Yeah, I was reticent to do it. I knew I had Dave Bazan's a friend and Richard Buckner's a friend, and they all do that stuff, living room shows. And they had recommended them to me, and I had never done them and was reticent to do them just because I'm used to clubs and a bit of an introvert and don't know how I do well socially. But they ended up being, they finally convinced me to do it, and I just wanted to try it. I'll try anything once, you know, and it just went really well. I just really enjoyed it because I think you're not at a venue all day. You know, you just kind of show up at 6:30, play your show, talk to a bunch of nice people, and then you get to leave without having to bring a bunch of gear out in the snow or whatever, you know. So it's quite an easy, comparatively, quite an easy, wonderful way to do it.
Do you see this being kind of the future of what you're doing for solo stuff?
I don't know if it'll be exclusively this. I do see myself doing more of them as long as there's a demand for it or whatever.
Yeah, I think when I saw you the first time, when I saw you last week, the first time that I actually heard of this living room thing and I brought it up to you was Damian Dorado, who's been on the show as well. And he does a lot of these, doesn't he?
I think he does. Yeah, I think he does. And I know Bazan does. I mean, so yeah, it seems sustainable, you know. So I'm thinking I'll do more of them. Rewarding to do, and just playing in that intimate of a setting is really rewarding.
Mm-hmm. Especially for those that are in the crowd, absolutely, that might not get the opportunity to talk to you before or after a show. Is it kind of weird to connect with people on that level?
Not for me. I think I can see how it could be. I considered that it would be before I did it. I was reticent because of that, but it turns out that you guys aren't that weird.
Well, that's nice. And you either. So it's a good fit, I think. It was a kind of a really neat way to get a little bit more intimate, not only with you as a human being, but with your music as well. Does it change the way that you play the songs?
Not necessarily. I mean, I could do those. I've done shows where I play songs exactly that way, you know, through a PA. I think it sounds better when you're just singing it in an open room with your voice and the guitar. A PA, you know, just putting it through a PA makes it sound too loud or too harsh or, you know, just not natural.
Right.
I mean, I'll do that too, and I'll be fine doing that, but I really enjoy playing without a PA.
Well, it was great to connect with you again, and of course we're talking today because there's a brand new record, and we're going to touch on all of that as well, but this show here, this show is about more or less your craft, the songwriting process, the production, and I wanted to talk to you because you're a great guy when it comes to some custom guitars and custom gear and things like that, but I wanted to touch on your beginning, and where were you born, Eric?
Greensboro, North Carolina, right. Was where I was born.
In Greensboro. So let's talk about your family real quick. In Greensboro, what was it like in the Bachmann household? How was it being a kid in that household?
Well, we moved a lot. My father was an insurance salesman, and my mother at that time was a homemaker and mom, and she ended up being substitute teacher and like a coach for the public schools I was in, or even later. But I moved to Franklin, Tennessee when I was maybe less than 1 year old, 2 year old. So I don't remember Greensboro at all. And I moved to Nashville, Franklin, Tennessee. This was 1972. And then in 74, we moved to Greenville, South Carolina. Or I guess it was really Malden, South or Simpsonville or Malden, South Carolina. And then I moved from Malden to St. Pete, Florida. And this is all before the age of 6 or 7.
Wow.
My parents separated, and then I didn't really have a relationship with my father because he was gone all the time, and I was sort of afraid of him because he was a pretty good disciplinarian. My mother was very sweet, but wasn't very communicative, but very sweet. And when I turned 8, we were in Florida, and they divorced. I had lived with my mother at first. From age 8 to 11, basically, and we moved a lot. She was trying to find work, and she was a single mom, and she worked as a bank teller and worked at different substitute teaching different schools, I think, or coaching maybe different schools. I was a kid, I don't remember, but it was through like the Catholic schools I was going to that the court was making me go to, through pressure from my dad, and to get us a proper education, which is fair enough. At age 11, my mother kind of ran out of money and just couldn't really afford to take care of us anymore. So she gave custody to my dad, who was at the time living in Chattanooga. When they divorced, he moved to Chattanooga and she stayed in St. Petersburg, Florida. And so then I moved to my dad's and developed a very good relationship with him then. I think the divorce kind of changed him, made him more communicative and made him more a present, you know. So he and I are very close now, which that was a bad time, but it was a good result of that bad time was that he and I have a good relationship now. So, and then we moved to Asheville, North Carolina when I was around 14 after living in Chattanooga for 2 or 3 years. Things were more stable with my dad because he was a little more, I mean, he was a middle class dude, you know, selling insurance at Provident, but it was stable, you know. And so then we moved to Asheville because he wanted us to be in the UNC college system because it's a good school system. Chapel Hill and NC State and all these schools are good schools, you know, and cheaper. So in high school, we went to Asheville. Actually, it was south of Asheville. We were in a city called Skyland or Arden, which is about 15 miles, 11 miles south of Asheville. And went to high school there.
Was there music played in your household, or how did music start for you?
Yeah, they were both music fans. My mother was a big country music fan. Her father, Floyd, played guitar. He was the only person in my immediate family who played an instrument. And he liked Hank Williams Sr. and, you know, Johnny Cash and things like that. So the first album I owned, my mother bought for me. I was 4. We were living in Franklin. Maybe I was 3. Franklin, Tennessee. And I got a little bitty record player. And it was maybe it was 74. Rhinestone Cowboy, Glen Campbell. And Folsom Prison Blues, the Johnny Cash Live at Folsom Prison record. And a Phyllis Diller record. Those were the first 3 records all, bought all at once for me by my mother.
Very nice.
And she was a big country music fan. Carter Family and Johnny Cash and Kris Kristofferson and Charlie Rich. And my father was more of a rock guy. He liked the Beach Boys and Bob Dylan and the Carpenters. And a lot of that stuff was, whenever I hear the Carpenters, I jokingly, but it's not really a joke, say that music sounds like my parents getting divorced. That Fifth Dimension, the Carpenters, you know, this kind of stuff. So that music was being played. They weren't instrumentalists, though. They didn't play anything. They just liked music. So I came to it on my own. My brother got a guitar and he never played it. And so finally, when I was 12 or 13, I started showing interest in it. And at age 13, I guess my mother bought me a little keyboard and my father rented me an alto saxophone when I was 14, 15, maybe. And I started taking lessons in alto saxophone and I ended up being an alto saxophone performance major in Boone at Appalachian State.
So there was keyboard and saxophone before the guitar altogether.
I didn't start playing guitar until I was 20.
So tell me about that. How did that happen?
I was in a band with a very good guitar player named R.L. Martin, who ended up playing on some Crooked Finger stuff later. And he's a teacher now in Atlanta and Asheville, and still a very good friend. And he's a great player. And he was a guitar player in the band. And I sang and played keyboards, and you know, we'd do like Led Zeppelin covers and Replacements covers and Cure covers and we'd write our own songs that sounded like those bands. They weren't very good, but it was still fun. And And we were both at Boone trying to make it work. And I was bored. I was a music major, and I just didn't want to be a high school band director. Not that there's anything wrong with that. Now I would have loved that job, but at the time I didn't want to do that. So I transferred to Chapel Hill, and he stayed in Boone. And so when I got to Chapel Hill, I wanted to play music. It was a little more happening scene than Boone, in my opinion. And I joined a band called Cupcake UK. So I bought an old Superhawk, G&L Superhawk. And the E string was broke. And so I was broke as hell. I didn't have any money. So I just went to practice without an E string. I was trained with theory and stuff. And I kind of, what I liked about, if you know how the guitar works, it was easy to not play a major or a minor third. Mm-hmm. It was easy to just play fifths without that high E string.
Right.
And I liked that. So when I finally got a new string on it, I took all the strings down instead to put the E string on top to get it out of the way, kind of like a banjo.
That's brilliant.
And then I don't know about that, but I did that and I started, I was in a band Cupcake UK, then I was in a band called Ream, and then I was in a band called Small, and then I started the Archers with Eric, Matt, and Mark, although Mark wasn't in the band yet. This is all in Chapel Hill. And then Small and the Archers were kind of both doing the same. We were both touring on the weekends, and I'd get out of class on Thursday, skip my Friday class, and we'd go up to Blacksburg, Virginia or New York and play shows. Up the East Coast, just playing shows to nobody, you know, to very few people. And then that got too busy. My grades were suffering and what have you. And so I quit Small and focused on the Archers.
So the Archers was certainly your brainchild.
Eric Johnson and I were shedding in his apartment or my apartment for 2 or 3 years before we got Matt on board, and then another year after we got Mark on board. So Eric Johnson and I had it. Just like two guitars. It was actually kind of cool because it was really droney, almost Celtic music, but distorted and droney. No words and just kind of, and then I started writing words, singing because it was fun to sing. And I couldn't sing, but I had a good time doing it. And I had a lot to say. You know, I had a lot that I wanted, I was angry about stuff, Walmarts and things, you know, first world problems that we have. And then we got Matt on board, and then we got this guy Clay Boyer to play drums, but it didn't quite work out with him. And then we got Mark Price to play drums.
I have friends that know Eric Bachmann but don't know Archers of Love. You know, tell me about what was going on at the time when you were pushing it a little bit more. Maybe the angst. What was going on then?
Well, I had been in other bands in high school where I sang, but I'd be mimicking things. You know, I'd just try to sound like, you know, Robert Smith or Bono or whatever, you know. Silly things like that. Robert Plant, you know, Paul Westerberg. And so we covered all this stuff. And I think you learn a lot doing that. As much of a dead end as that is to play those songs and to learn all those songs, it is good to do it because you can learn the structure and you can learn what makes the song work. So I sang in other bands, but I never had done it from my own voice or from my own perspective I was never required to find my own voice or to figure out what it was I was going to say or do. And so with the Archers, that was the search for that. And Small, I was trying to sound like Mission of Burma or J Mascus or something, you know. And you can hear that very clearly in those records. And I played on one EP, a small EP. And then with the Archers, I was just trying to figure out what else to do. You know, I was trying to figure out what to do and how to express myself from my own voice. So sometimes you get it right and sometimes you don't. So that's kind of a documentation of me getting it right and me getting it wrong all in the same breath. To me, that's how I perceive that music, the Archers of Love, early on especially.
Do you remember the first show that you got out there and really, you know, kind of tore people's faces?
Yeah, actually, it was pretty bad. It was at a place called, the very first Archers show was at this place called the Hard Rock or the Hardback Cafe, I forget. It was off of Franklin Street in Chapel Hill on Columbia, right at the intersection of Franklin and Columbia. And it was a much different city back then. Right now, you know, it's a freaking mall now, you know. But back then, it's a little different. But, and I had a crush on this girl in one of my psychology classes, or one of my classes or something. Tall girl, real pretty, real smart, Chapel Hill, you know, college girl, whatever. But kind of wholesome. And I was kind of a weird rat punk looking. I had, like, hair in my face. I had hair back then. And I would wear, like, plaid cutoff shorts down to my shins, you know, and Doc Martin, whatever, boots, cheap boots I bought, shitty boots I bought. For $10 at a shoe store or whatever, ratty t-shirt. I was doing dishes at the Carolina Coffee Shop. And for some reason, she thought I was weird or interesting enough to talk to. And she was kind of a sorority girl. She wasn't a sorority girl, but she was kind of that clean cut, you know. Mm-hmm. And I was not. And I invited her to the show. And I think we played Fat, the song Fat, where I just yell fuck in the beginning of the song. And I saw her, like, not that moment, but like shortly after singing that song, and she had this expression of total fear in her face. She just left, and I never spoke with her again. I saw her in class like 2 days later. She just ignored me.
I was hoping there was going to be like, and we were prom king and queen after.
No,
that.
No. Total rejection. She was repulsed by my anger. I was like, well, whatever, lady. You know, I was always self-loathing. So I was never like, you don't know what you're missing. I knew what she was missing, and she was fine to miss it. I'm not a good catch. I didn't believe I was a good catch or anything, but I thought, fuck you, you know?
Yeah. Did you write a song about her?
Nah, not directly. I wrote songs that I had actual relationships about people, you know, or I'd write about a specific part of the relationship, not getting the person. Mm-hmm. Well, I didn't write a song about her. I didn't warrant it, you know.
You
it wasn't long enough. There wasn't enough depth to the thing to make an interesting song.
Yeah, just the look on her face was enough, right?
But it's looking back at it now. It's pretty funny. And that happened to me a few times.
I'm sure it did, man. I'm sure it did. You know, you guys got back out on the road, you know, going back five or 6 years ago now, I guess. What was that like for you to get back on stage with those guys?
It was amazing. That's the thing you can't, it was in terms of just being fun. It was really fun, amazingly fun. I thought, it would be, because you can't ever, you know, if there's anything that band has, it's chemistry. The four people kind of grew up together, all from Asheville, all kind of same socioeconomic background, the same kind of kids, you know. And so there's a connectivity that you have, a chemistry that you have. And so I knew we would have that again, and we did. And so that part of it's always rewarding and fun. And I think probably entertaining to watch, because you can kind of, those are sort of the mysterious things that make bands great, you know. So it was really fun. It's funny, though, you do it for a while, and all the things that bored you to begin with start boring you again. Just playing the songs the same way over and over again. And, you know, even if it was just 30 shows in 1 year, 25 shows in 1 year, all that stuff creeps up quickly. It was great, but by the end of it, I was kind of glad it was over.
Mm-hmm. And is it over? Is that it?
I don't know. I don't want it to be, because I would like to revisit it when it makes sense for everybody to do it, just because it's so rewarding to play with those guys. And I think they feel the same way. So I think at this point, the fear is not just playing old songs. I haven't been able to write anything, and the band hasn't been able to spend enough time together, because we all live in different cities, to work on something. So I would want to, I don't know if this will happen, I would want to write another 7-inch, or write a 4 or 5 songs, or write an hour, whatever it would be, before we attacked it again in a bigger way, you know, like did a bunch of shows. Mm-hmm. Because I don't want to end up playing old songs over and over again. I mean, I'll do that if you pay us too much money. Yeah, I'll do that. We do that. If a festival offers us 30 grand, yeah, we'll do it. You know, not a dumbass, but but I think if we're going to actually go out and play 25 more shows in the course of a year on the weekends or whatever, whenever it would be, you know, or do a little tour, we would need to have something to tour on. But it's not happening. I'm trying to write it, and it's not coming out. And we're not spending enough time together to have it come. You know, it's just a difficult thing. So we'll see.
Yeah, I mean, it would have to be certainly a different mind frame for you to write an Archer's song as opposed to, you know, a Crooked Fingers or a Bachman song.
That, yeah, or not, and just let that band take what I do. Because the great thing about that band was that I trusted them enough to rip apart what I did. It was very deconstructive. I would come in with what I had. Like, you heard me play those Archer's of Love songs at that Cincinnati show. That's what I wrote. Mm-hmm. And so you're hearing it kind of just the song, and that's how it was sort of heard in my head. And then they take it, and they, in a very cool, like, Matt will play different chords under the song to make it do different things, you know. And Eric Johnson, of course, does whatever the hell he does. Mm-hmm. It's fantastic to me. He's my favorite guitar player. So it's kind of it's very fun for me to put the songs through that process, you know. And, you know, I don't know if part of my mind is agreeing with you. Part of my mind is saying, yeah, you know, I could never give Archer's Man of War or A Little Bird. Mm-hmm. Couldn't do it, you know. And it wouldn't make sense. If Archer's fans heard us do that, they'd be pissed off about it, you know, and they probably should be, whatever, I don't care, but they would be. So there is that element to it. But there's another side of my brain where, well, if I gave them a different kind of song that I've done, though, as Crooked Fingers, like Bad Blood, then that could work. You know, there's songs that would, and there's songs that wouldn't. And at this point, it's really just a matter of getting together long enough to do it, or for me sort of being able to compartmentalize things so I could present, okay, here's a song that I'm going to do with the Archers, but it ends up going to whatever project I'm on at the time. I'm not precious with things. Like, I don't mind handing somebody a song and having them rip it apart, and then we'll just put it through that filter and it'll be a different thing. I don't have a problem. Like, I would love to hear what the Archers would have done with Little Bird. They'd have torn it up. I'm sure it would have been something vastly different, you know? I'm not afraid of that kind of thing, you know? But I don't know if he'd ever do it.
That song's lovely on its own. I'm kind of glad it didn't go to Archers.
Well, that's my point, right? Because if you do it, if you do it, then you piss off, or you don't piss anybody off. Nobody cares that much, but you lose people that would like it, like people that like Eric Bachman or Crooked Fingers more. That doesn't, they're not happy about that. And the people like the Archers more, well, they're not happy that you have this sensitive subject matter or whatever.
Right.
Smartass, you know.
Yeah, but I mean, still, Archers was doing stuff like Chumming the Ocean, and there were still some of those delicate moments with the Archers well.
That's right.
Right. So there's
there's something in there. It just got to chisel away at it. It's just a constant, you know, searching for it kind of thing.
Right.
So maybe we'll figure something out.
Mm. Let's talk about the evolution from once Archers kind of closed up shop for a bit, and then along comes the Swan Record and Crooked Fingers and that moniker. Was that a conscious shift to change the way that your vocal delivery was? Like, let's talk about going from Archers to Crooked Fingers.
Yeah, I don't think it was. It was certainly conscious. It wasn't. You know, the thing that frustrates me is if people say you changed your voice. I did change it, but it was medical. It was because my voice was shredded. And I had to learn how to not sing like that, because if I kept screaming like that, my voice would be gone, you know?
Yeah.
So I sort of just started singing from my stomach more and less from my throat, and that's what it sounds like. So, and I definitely, so the sound of things, it was more just a medical choice, just like a physical choice I don't want to not have a voice when I'm 50, so I'm going to need to start, singing from my stomach. You know, that's just what I needed to do. So I did that.
Right.
And that's what it sounds like. The perspective, though, there was a very strong desire in me to alienate Archers fans. Like, I wanted to write, like, the Archers were smart aleck and sarcastic to a degree, you know, and I wanted, and that was the character that I was singing from or I'm writing from. That's cool. And I you know, still could do that, I guess, but that's what it was. And so I knew I wanted the next thing to be more sentimental and storytelling. And I knew I was going to lose people.
Did that excite you?
Yes. Not even that it would be that you were losing people, but just that you were going to not be, that you were just going to look under all these rocks you haven't looked under yet and explore this thing that you hadn't explored yet that I was interested in. So that was a very conscious thing to do. And in a weird way, when people didn't like it, or when they didn't like Crooked Fingers because it wasn't enough like the Archers, or just didn't match that, it was a success to me.
Did you hear instant backlash from it?
Yeah. I mean, you heard, you know, people that reviewed records that used to like Archers didn't like it. You hear a lot of that stuff, but that was what was exciting about it for me. You know,
mm-hmm.
You know, you weren't just like, okay, I'm just gonna write more Web in Fronts. I'm just gonna keep on doing that. Oh, Loud and Quiet. Let's just keep doing Loud and Quiet. People love that shit. They just eat that up. You know, Loud and Quiet, Loud and Quiet, Loud and Quiet.
Yeah, but to you, it could have been Vanilla all day, and you wanted some new flavor, right?
Yeah, I just wanted to do what I felt compelled to do. You know. You know, the thought goes into it too because of what you're listening to. If you talked to me when I was 20, I was listening to Band of Susans and Mission of Burma and, you know, Theoretical Girls and, you know, Glenn Branca and stuff. I was listening to the guitar, stuff like that, and that's what that influenced that band. And throughout that time, throughout the Archers days when we're driving these long drives and playing between shows, I'm listening to Richard Thompson and Lee Hazelwood and Leonard Cohen and just whoever, you know, Townes Van Zandt, whatever. So I was starting to find, you know, I knew this music more from my mother growing up as a kid, but I was revisiting that and kind of coming to it again with a more open mind and just more love. Because as a kid, you're presented this stuff and you don't really think about it, you know. And I was kind of coming to that. So I wanted to write stories, you know.
How many songs did you have, before the Swan record, so to speak? I mean, obviously you got all of those songs out onto that record. Was there a whole stockpile of that material before?
No, there weren't, because I was essentially writing the next Archers record. I mean, Crown and Chrome and White Trash Heroes are the same sonic palette. They're the same, you know, little keyboard sound that I put through a delay and compress. And, you know, they're the same thing and the same lyrical approach. So it's kind of, and those were, you know, White Trash Heroes was on Archer's record, Crown and Chrome was on the first Crooked Fingers record. So it's really just where I took it. But I had probably, when the Archers stopped, I probably had like four of those songs. I'd say like Crown and Chrome, New Drink, maybe A Little Bleeding. Maybe a couple of the songs were written and they were going to be intended to be Archer songs, but then the Archers kind of broke up. And that was a big relief at that time. Mark was the one who kind of pulled the plug, the drummer, because his wrist, and he was just kind of tired of doing it. But when he said it, I was like, yeah, man, let's quit. Let's stop while we're ahead.
Right.
So, and I had four or five songs ready. And then when that decision was made for the band to stop after White Trash Heroes, I just kept writing and started playing solo shows. They were atrocious, but I started playing those and trying to get, you know, find a voice to sing from, a perspective to sing from where I knew it wouldn't remotely be compared to the Archers, you know?
Do you remember the very first one that you did?
Yeah, I think I opened for Bob Mould, Pennsylvania, right. Somewhere, maybe the Trocadero in Philly.
Were you scared?
No, I wasn't scared. I was drunk. And I'm not even being funny. That's just kind of how it was back then. But I felt like I was excited about a new chapter. I was excited about, you know, new things you could do musically. And I just felt, but it was always a party, you know, and that was continuing. So
sure. So since you and I have known each other, I mean, I think the first time I interviewed you was for the Snakes record. I was going back a little while, but you've always been a bit of a lonely traveler, and you know, no matter what, the cast of characters that support you is always evolving, like the band is always changing. Is that a conscious thing for you?
Yeah, I think it's conscious, but a lot of it's economic. I mean, it's, you know, I'm lucky to live in Athens, and I have a bunch of friends here that are good musicians, so it's just easier to play with them than have to fly people in. It's just too expensive to fly all people in that used to play on stuff, you know, from Seattle or whatever.
Yeah.
Or from Denver or from North Carolina or whatever. So I feel like a lot of those decisions are just, they're friends of mine that can play, because I have a lot of friends that are musicians, and I just ask them to do it if I'm in the same town as them. Mm-hmm. But I do like the idea. Here's what's conscious. Here's what I think you're getting at. I knew after the Archers, I never wanted to have songs that I had to play the same way. It's kind of bad for marketing. It's kind of bad for like building your rock and roll band brand or whatever, you know, but I just I got so tired of playing the songs the same way. It wasn't even the songs. It's just the arrangement. But that's the very thing people respond to in a band, isn't it? So mm-hmm. Part of why I ask different people to do it all the time is because I know we'll play it differently. Because I don't really tell people what to play. I mean, the song's a song and it's there. You got to stay within that framework of the chords or whatever. But I never tell people what to do. So as long as they're within the general vague structure of the song frame, you know. Because for me, it's very rewarding to hear the songs differently. Keeps it refreshing. Touring is easier when you're not bored with the songs.
So it's a completely selfish thing.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Very cool. Yeah, I think the first time was at a tiny little spot in Toronto called the Rivoli, and those were the Barton Carroll days, and it was Barton. I think Matt even came out, didn't he? Was he playing those early shows with you, with Crooked Fingers?
Well, the early Matt Gentling did not. He only joined in on Dignity and Shame, and he was in that one tour.
Okay.
And that was in 2004 or 5, maybe 5. But the Rivoli, I think that was 90. That was 2002 or 3.
Yeah, it was back in the day, man.
It was way back. If it was Bring on the Snakes, that would have been Joe and RL.
Okay, that's right. Yeah, and that
Joe's a police officer now.
And I just brought that up last week. That was when you were mine. There was an upright bass, I think, in that.
Yeah, Joe. Well. Man, I'd hire Joe again in a second. But Joe's a cop, man. He's a police officer in Atlanta. He's close to me. Like, it would be great to work with him again. But yeah. He's too busy keeping us. He's too busy not being shot at.
What a
They're
time.
Trying to not be shot at.
Yeah, what a time to live in right now. I love telling the To the Races story for people that I introduce your music to. Can you take me through the story behind the very first, you know, Eric Bachman release and To the Races, the hotel, the van. Tell me about that little era again.
Well, I was living in Seattle in Crown Hill, the neighborhood next to Ballard, which is now a very hip neighborhood. And it was hip then, but it wasn't as nearly as hip as it is now and crowded as it is now. But I was living there and my rent was maybe $800 a month and I was gone all the time. Mm-hmm. And I had my own little house, tiny little 600 square foot house, but it was mine. I didn't have any housemates, roommates. And I had just come back from all this touring where I took out 6 people and I just was hemorrhaging money and had lost a lot of money on that tour. And the record did okay, but not enough to, you know, bring me in tons of money. So I wasn't broke, but I was not interested in spending what little money I had on rent when I was going to be gone all the time. I had a European tour coming up and I had some other dates opening for bands. So I just moved out. It was summer and it was about to be summer and I moved out of my house, paid my last month's rent, cleaned it up, moved out. And I had a van. So I thought, well, let me just live in the van. And, in the summer, I'll park here. I know these streets really well. I parked in Ballard and Crown Hill. I knew where to park where I wouldn't get bothered at night. I had joined the Y so I could take showers. And I knew there were a bunch of nice like pho restaurants and Vietnamese restaurants and stuff in that general neighborhood. So it was never hard for me to get food or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I had a space in the back of my van to write, and I wanted to write.
This is after Taipei?
No, this is before Taipei.
Okay, all right.
This is way before Taipei. All this right, is in okay. 2006, 2005.
Okay.
This is after Dignity and Shame. This is the To the Races record.
Right.
And so I basically started doing that. Within the first 2 weeks, I got really depressed because I was basically a 35-year-old man and I was getting drunk every night. It's actually a good thing because I stopped drinking and stopped smoking around this time.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was I would get drunk. I'd go out to a Tin Hat or a bar, you know, Sloop bar, some bar in that neighborhood, and I would get drunk. I was occasionally working at Sub Pop in the mailroom because my friend, my lawyer now, Sean, was a licensing and A&R guy at Sub Pop, so he got me this job at Sub Pop in the mailroom. So I was doing that some, and I'd go out and get drunk, and then I'd go to sleep in my van. I would be like, man, I'm drunk in my van, 35 and asleep. I'm not really getting songs written. I'm not really doing anything. So I got kind of depressed, and I stopped drinking. And to combat that, I stopped drinking, and that was the best thing because I got more disciplined about what I was doing. So I would get up. This is about after a month of just that mess. So I would get up probably 8 or 9 when the sun was coming up. And I'd go to the Y and I'd take a shower and I'd work out and take a shower. And then I would go get some food and then go to my van in Golden Gardens Park at the Puget Sound. If you go down Crown Hill, I don't know if you know Seattle very well, but there's this beautiful park on the Puget Sound. And I would just sit there, I'd park my van and I'd sit in the back of my van and I had a little fan blowing on me to keep me cool. And I'd have the windows down and I'd just work on songs. Then I get hungry, I go eat, get coffee, I had a thermos full of coffee, whatever, and I would just work on songs 10 hours a day, just work on them. Some would go down, I'd go eat, maybe go work out again, and then I'd find a place, a kind of private, quiet, shady place to park where nobody would notice, and I'd sleep. Probably about 1 a.m, I'd go to sleep. And I just did that all day, all 2 or 3 months in a row. And if I had to go tour, I'd go tour and come back and do it again, you know.
Right.
And it ended up being probably the most effective, efficient, creative time in my, at least in terms of efficiency. It was such a great, I highly recommend it to anybody that wants to get work done because you're alone, you're making it dignified and you're Spartan. You're not wasting anything and you just get so much work done and there's clarity in the work and it's just a good thing to do. And I miss doing it. I wish I could do it again. And maybe I will do it again one day if my wife will let me, but It's not all van down by the river. It's none of that. If you're willing to you know make it dignified, like go work out, eat right,
yeah,
exercise, be diligent with your work. You know, it ended up being the best. And I recorded all these things on a little digital recorder I had, and probably wrote 20 songs, and 10 or 11 of them made it on the record, whatever it was.
Right.
And then I went on tour for that record, and I moved to Denver because I met a girl, and that screwed all that up. Right. She's a nice girl, and everything didn't work out, but.
Tell me about the recording.
Oh, yeah. My dad lives in Asheville, and I'm close with him. So I was visiting him. You know, I lived in Seattle, but I was coming to visit him. And I was just starting up this relationship with this girl in Denver. And I was in North Carolina, and I thought, well, let me just rent. I know how to record this. Let me just rent a hotel. It's off season. Mm-hmm. It was like January. And the Outer Banks are not as crowded then. And I knew hotels would be cheap. So I rented a hotel for about a week and a half or 2 weeks. In Buxton, North Carolina, which is where the Cape Hatteras Lighthouse is. And there's always people that live there, but it's just easy to get a hotel for cheap. And I rented this hotel room and I set up all my recording gear and I decided to record that To the Races album there, at least track it there and I'd mix it somewhere else, you know. Yeah. And it was very stripped down, obviously. And I ended up tracking everything there. It took me longer than I thought, though, because there's a lot of bad weather. It's, you know, the Outer Banks are pretty rugged weather-wise in the winter. And there was always this kind of windy sound. And you would think it might be cool in one song, but through a whole album, it's just not a good idea. It was too gimmicky. It just wasn't cool. So I couldn't track during those times, which is like 50% of the time or more. So I ended up having to like kind of be awake and listen to the weather all the time to make sure I could, okay, it's quiet now. Let's record, you know?
Right.
And I basically played the songs 10 times each, got good performances on them. It was on my Mac and I had a computer, did it all digitally. And then I took it to Austin, Texas after that. And got Miranda Brown to sing backups. And then I came up through Denver and I got Tom Hagerman to play some violin on it.
Mm-hmm.
And he let me play his piano a little bit. He had a piano there. Mm-hmm. We'll spin it. That's on like Man of War and Little Bird and stuff.
Yep.
And then I took the files and I sent them to Martin Fevier in Seattle and he mixed them.
And that's the record.
And that's the record.
I love the thought of you alone in a hotel room recording that with an.
January in Buxton. I mean, I'd do it again in a second. I mean, it's difficult to write things that are so unadorned because you can always add a pretty string part or add a pretty guitar, cool guitar, or an interesting guitar part or something to make a song a little more interesting. But when you're just doing it that stripped down,
yeah,
you really have to make sure the song works at the most primitive way. So in the most primal way. So yeah, I would do that again. It's just a lot of work, you know.
And that whole record is, if I'm not mistaken, is that the same nylon guitar throughout the entire record?
It is. Yeah. It is.
Yeah. See, like that in itself, what a concept. You know, how many people would not be able to do that? Just to stick with the exact same tool for the entire record, and it works so beautifully, you know?
Well, yeah, and there's people that think it doesn't work beautifully, but they're wrong, so it's okay. It's the kind of thing where you do it, and you know that there's going to be flaws in it, but it's a nice documentation of where you are at the time, so you do it. I mean, the intention that you have when you make records your whole life is so vastly different than the intention that a reviewer might have reviewing it, or that a blog or a online magazine might have. Like they'll review it from a perspective that is so fascinating to me because it's so inaccurate.
Yeah.
Like what I'm doing is documenting moments of my life. Mm-hmm. And they're talking about things that you aren't even intending at all. And that's fine. You might hear it that way and that's fine, but it's just such a fascinating thing to hear people review stuff because they're not oftentimes, not always, sometimes people do get it, but oftentimes they're running from a perspective that you never. It's just a shallow approach.
Sure. Yeah, you and I have talked about that.
I'll put it that way. Yeah.
Yeah, we've talked about that before. That's why I try to stay on. You've already told me how grumpy you are. I try to stay on your good side when it comes to shit like that.
Fair enough.
So let's go from that record, and then we've fast-forwarded 2011, and that was Breaks in the Armor. And then now we've got a brand new solo release. So you could tell me what has transpired within the past. Obviously, you and Liz got married and everything. But like, I mean, from 2011 up into this brand new record, what has transpired within that time?
Well, the Archers thing happened. The Archers reunion happened in 2012, I think, 2011. And I joined Nico Case's band.
Yeah, that's right.
And I had just come back in 2009. I went to Taiwan to teach English and just kind of get away from music for a while. Mm-hmm. So that kind of was a really good thing to do. It kind of reset my attitude and made me less grumpy, which is good because you can get jaded by things, and it's very important to not be jaded. So I got back from Taiwan. I started dating Liz because she lived in Athens, and I had come back to Asheville, and I think we were supposed to play some shows together. And so we just sort of hit up a relationship. And anyway, I moved to Athens. I had written a bunch of songs in Taiwan because I had no intention of writing songs, but that became Breaks in the Armor. And I did a big tour with that with a couple of Athens musicians and Liz, Matt Nelson and Jeremy Wheatley, who are still playing with me. Mm-hmm. And Liz at that time. And then when that tour ended, the Archers decided to do a reunion. I think maybe we were doing some of the reunion before that too, and then I joined Nico Case's band. So that has been quite consuming. After the Archers reunion and stuff in 2012, I joined Nico's band, and she put out her The Worst Things Get record. Mm-hmm. And
beautiful record.
Yeah, and I toured with that. And of course, the first 8 months to a year after she put that out, she had us out on the road. You know, we were just touring like crazy. So that made it difficult to write, and occasionally I'd try and write, but I couldn't get anything finished. And Archers did some more reunion shows. I might have played a solo tour here and there just kind of to try to remember my songs because I was playing all these Nico songs. And, essentially it took me 5 years because Nico had me so busy to make a new record.
And you're doing that again, aren't you? You're getting back at it again. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm going out with her in September, and I'm going out with her again in November, and hopefully we'll be playing a little bit on her new record. We'll see how that goes. I'm going to rehearse some of the new songs with her, but she's very picky about what she lets on her records, obviously, mm-hmm. and as she should be. And so I'm going to be in Tucson some tracking in November with her, but I don't know if it'll make it on the record or not.
Right.
But then after that, because I've gotten married and because I want to sort of spend more time at home and do more of my own thing again for selfish reasons, I'm gonna resign from her band starting January 2017. So it's amicable. I wish I could, I wish there was 48 hours in a day, or there's just more time in the world. But I have to kind of, if I'm going to do any more Archer stuff, any more of my own stuff, be married, and do Nico, it's just not going to work. Something has to stop. So the Nico thing is what's going to go,
Sure. Okay, so
which is a shame because I loved playing with her and I loved that band and those people in that band. But it was a great experience, and she's a great boss,
I have two comments to make on the Nico front. Number one is that I had to drive to Cincinnati 9 hours to see you and then came back and found out that there's a Toronto date, so you are coming back to Toronto.
With Nico.
Yeah, with Nico. Don't get
With
me
Nico,
wrong.
yeah.
And two, the first time that I saw you play with Nico, I think was for a Tiny Desk concert. And if you remember way back in the day, you used to talk about wearing a cape,
Oh, yeah.
and you got to wear a cape when you played that show, because I think you guys were
Yeah.
doing the Halloween thing. So
Well, that's,
it was nice to
yeah.
see you wear the cape for once.
Yeah, I mean, I wish I could say that I chose to wear that cape. Kelly Hogan made me wear that kind of, because she wants you to dress up. They wanted me to dress up for the Halloween. It was all Halloweeny.
Yeah, it was empowering. Don't lie. You loved
Yeah,
wearing
it
the
was
cape.
empowering because I was playing the piano, but it wasn't my courage that caused me to do it. You know what I mean? It wasn't me being a great artist or anything.
Sure,
It was
sure.
me just doing what I was asked to do by Kelly Hogan, her backup singer.
All right.
Oh, yeah.
I'm glad you brought up the piano because I want to talk about the new album. It's absolutely beautiful. It's I know it's only, what is it, August? It's the album of the year for me. That usually happens with any Eric Bachman release. Heavy Hours was my favorite song of that year as well. But
Thanks.
this, tell me about the development of the self-titled Eric Bachman record with a prepubescent Eric Bachman holding the baseball bat on the cover. There's some real stripped down songs. There's some real heavy content on this record. Tell me where you're at as far as this brand new one goes.
Well, I don't know if it was intentional to write what I wrote about. I always feel like I'm writing about things that are personal to me at the time. The idea that the press release said it was my most personal songs, or that I called them my most personal songs, that's not accurate because I didn't call them my most personal songs. They might be, but I didn't intend for that. I always feel like they're personal. I always try to write from a place like that. But I feel like, because having some perspective on it now that it's been out for a few months, because I had 5 years to write it, it did give me enough time to sort of inhale and exhale a couple of times and reposition my feet so that it sounds different. That there's just different subject matter and different, just a different perspective that I'm writing from, without me even realizing I was doing it. So I always feel I always felt the most important for me, one of the most important criteria is to not waste people's time. Like, if you're going to write songs, if you're going to write anything, if you're going to make something and you're going to ask people to listen to it, make sure that they don't feel like they're wasting their time when they're doing it.
Okay.
So I always was reticent to write about personal ideas of, like religion or whatever, because people don't give a shit, but a song like Mercy or a song like Carolina that my wife wrote, those songs are dealing with that issue. So I don't know why I finally got mustered up the courage to write about that stuff or to do that. Maybe it's just the political climate that we live in down here anyway in the US. I don't know. I just felt like it was time to write about that, and it kind of came out not easily, but it came out naturally. It came out very when it came out, I knew it was right to do it. So it didn't feel forced, So, and singing about things like capital punishment and singing about these things, I never would have done it before because I didn't want to consume people with my personal politics because no one gives a shit, But for some reason, it came out that way. And maybe people still don't give a shit, maybe whatever, but I feel good about having done it, almost purged, like it was something I felt like I had to do because I hadn't done that yet.
Was there a sense of, when we talk about some of the political stuff, you talk about, obviously you're from the South. Have you got beef with the South?
Of course, I mean, anybody in it with a conscience would, for the obvious historical reasons of slavery and what have you, but and just the archaic mindset based on scripture that people legislate based on archaic texts. It's wrong to be gay, these ridiculous things, these and groups spawn from that sanctioned discrimination with violence, and it's just all this stuff is coated over by this. Well, yeah, the South is so hospitable, though, and the food and all this great literature and all this stuff. And I'm like, fuck you, man. It's still not cool. Mm-hmm. Because all the great art coming out of it is responding to the hypocrisy, you know, and responding to the toxic environment that is the South, you know.
Right.
And then all the delicious food that you're talking about, well, that's all from Europe or Africa or the Caribbean, you know. And you certainly have made it your own. I'm not taking that from it, but it comes from a place that's not just the South. We started it. You didn't start it. You filtered it, you know.
Right.
So anyway, I'm from here. So I feel – and I also feel like there's a lot of I'm going to get on my soapbox here. There's a lot of people that use it as an artistic environment or background. Like some guy was trying to make a movie about the South. And some of his footage, he showed it to me. He wanted me to write a song for it or something. He showed it to me, and he was like driving by a KFC and a Taco Bell, like on some country road. I'm like, "Are you on Facebook? Are you have a cell phone? Because the South that you're talking about is gone." And it was also racist and slave owners and stuff, you know.
Yeah.
So and then you're showing a picture of this corporation that's based out of, you know, I don't know where they're based out of, but it's a big city, and they're not. You know, they're not worried about Southern culture. You know, they might be using it or exploiting it to make money, but they're not. So I don't know. There's just a lot of hypocrisy. There's a lot of stuff like that I don't.
It's warranted. And you know, when I'm listening to songs like, you know, the ones that we're talking about, it's. I just wondered where your head was at, because I know that you've been steeped in that stuff for a long time and you're from there. But then, you know, I wanted to ask, and you don't have to, you know, answer this from a personal level, but, you know, when I hear songs like Modern Drugs and, you know, we talk about IV and there's a couple of things like that. Was there a loss that was certainly more connected to you on a personal level when this record was being written? You know, I picture
Not specifically. I think that the attached to two IVs is specifically referring to the process of lethal injection. You know, when you're lethally injected, when you're executed that way, they put two IVs in one in your arm. If one fails, they make sure there's a backup.
Right.
So that's what that's specifically referring to.
Well, I'm talking about that, and then of course I heard that you were in the hospital.
Yeah. You know. Well, there's a lot of. Yeah, I mean, I know a lot of people that have mental situations. I don't really feel at liberty to talk about them because they're people and their personal lives are a thing. But they didn't die, but they have been having issues. But that's not a new thing. That happens to a lot of people, you know, mm-hmm. which is probably why I felt like the song should be written. But to be honest with you, I think that song kind of fails because that song only gets to the surface of it. Like, I don't hate that song or anything, but I wish I could have had... I wish I could have figured out a way to make that song have more of a lyric, because I'm not saying what I intended to say as clearly, like I talked about not wasting people's time. Like, well, it's a nice little pop song or whatever, but it's not. It broaches the subject matter, but it doesn't get to this idea that we're over medicated. You know, it doesn't get to that idea. You know.
Yeah, but it created a dialogue right now. I mean,
it did. Yeah, it did. So there you go. But it's if you think about not wasting people's time and writing songs and writing the efficient, most efficient song possible. That's to me, that song feels a bit of a letdown for me. It's probably my least favorite song on the record for that reason.
I think it's my favorite.
Well, good. That's good actually, because that's the proof that you just because you. Think something about your music doesn't mean that's what it is. I'm the last person to judge it. You know what I mean? Yeah. I should be the last person to judge it.
Well, it's not yours anymore. You gave it away.
That's right. That's right.
Right. Okay. So what's next for you? I know Nico, and then when you get back home, what will did you get your garden going? Have you guys got a garden?
My wife's garden. She's got a her herbs are like the basil and the. She's got three different kinds of basil and some dill and some mint. That's really good. She's got a lot of flowers this year. We tried tomatoes the last few years, and in Georgia, you should be able to grow a fine tomato, but they always get this blossom end rot stuff. And I think we need to lime the soil more. I don't know. Anyway,
tomatoes are tough.
She's the gardener, not me.
Right, right, right.
I'm the lawn maintenance person. I mow the lawn and what have you. She'll do that when I'm gone, but, we have about an acre of land and it's all on a slope.
Right.
So it's hard for us to grow grass, but we have sections of the yard that need to be mowed, and we have a lot of coyotes. We have a nice dog. We can't let the dog out in the yard because of the coyotes.
Right. Let me ask you this. Is it strange for you to reflect upon this time and say, wow, I'm a guy who's married, who has a dog and a house, and, you know, the domesticated Eric Bachman? Is that a strange
thing?
Yeah,
you know, it is strange. I'm very lucky that I got through to this point. I feel like it's kind of a, I don't feel guilty about it or weird about it. I don't feel like my art suffers because of it. I don't feel like any of that bullshit. I feel great about it. And I feel like it's the right place for me to be. And I don't feel weird in the sense that it's the, I feel like it's the right place for me to be. Right. I do feel like there's the self-loathing part of the personalities that we all have. The self-loathing part is still kind of in disbelief that I'm in such a good spot that way.
Take it in, man.
Not because I'm a bad person or whatever, or a good person or whatever, but because the choices I made to be gone all the damn time. I mean, I've been gone 10 months of the year for the last 25 years.
Right.
So when you do that, you tend to not develop, you tend to not be able to maintain relationships. So it just so happens I married somebody that had also done that for 12 years, you know, so she understands. So that's kind of the only way it would have worked.
Well, it's nice to see, you know, everything come full circle for you.
Until she dumps my ass and it's over.
There you go. You're doing it again. Don't do that to yourself, man.
Yeah. Hopefully that won't happen.
Well, you know, the soundtrack that you've got, you know, that has been not only the library, the back catalog of your life, has been the soundtrack to my life and so many others. And, you know, I can't thank you enough because you've always welcomed me in, you know, to that aspect of your life. You and I have always been able to have these kind of candid conversations, but I know that fans of, you know, not, I almost get kind of pissed off when people call it the Archer stuff, because I was a fan of your solo material, and then I ended up going back to Archer's, you know, right, afterwards. So right, you know, for you to kind of continue this chapter and be such an open book, man, I can't thank you enough.
Thank you so much, Matt. Good luck with your new baby.
Thanks, brother. You take care, man.
Take care, man.
Thank you. Bye-bye. There you go, my chat with Eric Bachman, ex-Archers of Loaf frontman, Crooked Fingers, and of course now his new solo record, which is out, and I urge you to go get that. I hope you enjoyed that. What a great guy. Really, really cool. I love the fact that he knows about, you know, the fact that I'm having a kid. You know, I love the fact that I know about his garden and about his wife, and he's just such an easy, down-to-earth guy to talk to. And this episode, I think, was one of my favorites. I've been waiting for a long time to get him on the show. The only thing I had to do was to drive to Cincinnati and try to put in the request. But I got face-to-face with him, and I said, man, I want to have you on the podcast. He said, yeah, just get in touch with Christina, my good friend Christina Rents at Merge Records, who made this possible. I love you, Christina. Thank you so much. And I hope everyone else enjoyed it. Get out there. Get that brand new record, okay? And if you have an opportunity to see Eric Bachman, whether backing up Nico Case or, you know, doing his own solo thing, maybe it could not quite possibly be in a living room, but on stage in your town, I urge you got to go check him out, especially on this tour, because he's playing just about everything, and man, it's beautiful. I thought it's contender for record of the year for me, and it's only August. That's how great the new record is, okay? All right, thanks again, Eric Bachman. A little teaser for you. Next episode of the show, Chris Murphy of Sloan spent well over an hour with me on Skype. And was just so cool enough that after the first time that I met him here in Peterborough for a show that they had, that's going back probably you know, 3 or 4 months ago, but I talked to him about having him on the show, and he agreed. He was supposed to be playing a show in Peterborough just a couple weeks ago, but it got rained out. A nice free outdoor event, the Hootenanny on Hunter, got kiboshed because Mother Nature was just not having it, so that kind of sucked. But he was still cool enough to honor our commitment to do the show, so if you're a big fan of Sloan. And here's a strange thing. I mean, I'm in Ontario. I don't think that I've had any you know, Canadian artists on the show, which is just bonkers. And Chris Murphy is just, this dude's a genius. And I love everything that Sloan does. But if I was going to pass the reins off to somebody as far as, you know, either doing another podcast or saying, all right, I'm hanging up my hat, you can take over, it would be this guy, because he's just too much of a charismatic talker, you know. He's not like me. He's not humming and hawing all the time. He knows what he's doing. And let's face it, they are Canadian icons, of course. So we are going to leave it at that. So thank you so much, and I hope you enjoyed the show. Head over to artproaudio.com. Check out the great deals that they've got on amazing gear. And looking forward to some other exciting happenings here on the show. I've got some other stuff to talk about coming up real soon. I'm also going to urge you to get out and give us a review on iTunes too. And as a bookend here, Some of those earlier episodes of the show disappeared. They are back now. Okay, so if you're a big fan, you didn't get to hear the Lee Ronaldo's, the Stephen Drozd episode of The Flaming Lips, or the Rob Schnapp, the producer who has worked with Elliot Smith and Beck and Guided by Voices, and those should be active now. So please do me a favor, download those episodes, give us a 5-star review, spread the love, tell people about Knobs. All right? It'll help us to keep doing what we're doing right here. I love you, Chris Nickel. Get back to me. He will be here for the Chris Murphy episode, which will be next, and hopefully in your ears before too late. All right? We're not going to make you wait anymore. This has been a fantastic episode of Knobs, and much love from our family to yours. Take care. Bye-bye.